You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's conversation is with Daniel Devizet, who is the author of The King of Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King, and many, many other books. He shared a 2001 Pulitzer Prize for his journalism and has worked for The Washington Post and The Miami Herald. His latest book is called The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Film Classic. So really cool conversation. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another letter left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Daniel Devizet, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
I think it's hard for people today to understand how unusual it was in an age before the internet and social media for performers to gain the kind of cross-cultural fame that John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd experienced when they were at the top of the charts. And this is in television, film, recorded, and live music. This is in the same time frame. So can you paint that picture? Because I just don't think people understand that that was so unusual.
Yeah, I mean, there was, what was there, one television station back then? Maybe there were a few, but there weren't many.
There were like six.
I don't know, WTTW and WGN, but Belushi and Aykroyd, well, Belushi in particular, was at the close of the 1970s, briefly on top of every medium. He had the number one comedy movie, which was Animal House, which Aykroyd was almost in, by the way.
Yeah.
He was the star of the biggest late night television show, which was Saturday Night Live, and Aykroyd wasn't far behind him. Aykroyd was actually the more versatile performer on that show, but Belushi was the bigger star.
Yep.
And they had the biggest record. They had the number one record. I saw this on the Rolling Stone charts or Billboard charts at one point. It was the first Blues Brothers record, which came out shortly before Blues Brothers film. It had no right to sell that many copies, but it did because mm-hmm. they were so huge.
I know the book is about the Blues Brothers, but it's more than that. And I'm curious, when you decided to write the book, did you know you would be writing about culture and the sort of broader implication and what it, and race and all these things that end up touching this book? Because I got to be honest, and you know, we corresponded when you were writing, and we would, yeah. you know, do, but I didn't know where you were going with it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I read that I'm like, oh, no, this is a big old book about a lot of things.
Yeah, I was following a formula. The formula is the same formula I used when I wrote a book called Andy and Don about Andy Griffith and Don Knotts. Hmm. That book, which is my greatest hit, sold a lot of copies, was about that friendship of these two Southern bumpkins in New York and then in Hollywood, and then the Andy Griffith Show, which was their greatest effort as a duo. And it was a dual biography that tracked their lives from the beginning to the end. So that's what I did with this book. I start out with Belushi getting born and moving to Wheaton, Illinois. And then I progress to where Belushi gets into Second City, and he then goes from there to National Lampoon. And then he meets Aykroyd. And then I go back to Aykroyd getting born, which is a few years after Belushi. And I take the reader through Aykroyd's life in Canada to where he was in an even more exalted Second City company, at least retrospectively, in Toronto. And then to where Belushi tries to recruit him to join National Lampoon and to where they end up together on Saturday Night Live. That's a lot of information, but that's basically the first, I don't know, third to half of the book. And then a huge gob on the ascent of the Blues Brothers, their birth, their sort of gestation as characters in Saturday Night Live. And then the entire Blues Brothers story through the making of the film, which occupies a huge, huge middle section of the book. I mean, it's, I don't know, maybe 100 pages about the film. And then the book ends with Belushi's memorial service, basically, after Belushi dies untimely. And then I have a little, very short, what do you call it, epilogue that just races through the years since then. But I it felt right to end with Belushi's death, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the book. And it's basically the same formula that I leveraged successfully with that Andy and Don book. And I think this friendship is as big a friendship as that friendship was.
Yeah, they're very different characters, right? And I met both John and Dan. I've been in more rooms with Dan than I was with John. And working at Second City, both of their legacy, I mean, you know, I was here when Farley died. So I got a sense of the sort of tragedy that happened, perhaps in the way that people felt when John died here and the people who knew him. And I want to key in on a certain point and it's before you came to Second City. So you, this is in chapter two, you talk about, he had a friend, Dan Payne, who introduced him to a summer theater program in rural Indiana. This is the Shawnee Summer Theater, right?
Yeah.
And you say, quote, "In truth, John didn't so much memorize lines as intentionally forget them. He was always improvising, trying to improve on the script. He struggled to stay in his assigned spot on stage. He tended towards overacting," end quote. This is a lore I've heard about, and it is both charming and, as you sort of state in the book, like, his fellow cast members didn't love this when he got to Second City, especially, right?
Yeah, and I should hasten to add that there's wonderful parallels between Belushi and Aykroyd. They aren't like people exactly. They're not very, very similar. I mean, just look at them. They're different. But they both apparently had this tendency to improvise. They weren't so much interested in memorizing the lines as in kind of building on them and creating this little force of nature around themselves on stage. Aykroyd's friends described the same thing when he was in university theater in Canada. And in Belushi's case, I interviewed, I think, just about all of his castmates in Chicago. Jim Fisher was kind of the campfire dad, maybe.
Yeah.
And the rest of them. And they all told me the same thing, which was he didn't really follow the rules. And there was really just this one rule, which is, and you'll say it better than me, that basically you're supposed to be working as a team. You're supposed to be supporting your castmates. You're this web of improvisation. You're supposed to be tossing the football gently around, the Nerf football, and just, you know, bringing each other out, making each other look good. And Belushi would do just anything but that. And it's a kind of miracle he didn't get punched in the nose, you know, over and over again. But I guess they loved him enough. He was lovable enough. And he would be really genuinely contrite after tramping all over them on stage. He would just forget himself, I guess.
I think that, so again, I knew Chris so much better, and I was on staff when he was on stage. And the comparison I understand because of the sadness of the end of their stories, but they were very different. Chris also attacked the stage, but he was such an insecure, vulnerable human being that he did support the other players, and he knew when to pull back in terms of that. And it just feels like John didn't know how to do that, but also John was breaking the mold, because that didn't exist at Second City prior to that. And if you look, and you've been here, you look at the wall of pictures and you go from the cast before, that Next Generation cast, and they are short hairs and they're in their suits, to a group that is in bell-bottom jeans with long hair. I mean, it was like the game had changed. And this is literally like 69, 70, right in that period.
And it's not, you know, credit for that goes not just to Belushi, of course, as I'm sure you'd be the first to say, this was a very young cast.
Yeah.
Belushi was not, in fact, the youngest person ever hired at Second City. I keep reading that, but it's not the case. But he was one of the youngest, and they were a very, very young group. And he wasn't even the first hippie on the cast. I believe Harold Ramis had the designation of sort of dedicated. And look at him. He was definitely a hippie. I'm gesturing with my hands to like
his fro.
Before Belushi arrived, Belushi kind of, I think, kind of slotted in. I think Harold Ramis went on a sabbatical or something. So, so they all were in that direction. Now, Jim Fisher would be quick to tell you, who again was kind of like the papa of the group. They didn't all do drugs. They didn't all smoke pot. They didn't all drop acid. They didn't all do crazy stuff like that. But if you look at the cast just a year before then, I mean, it looks like a picture from the 1950s with its ties and Brittle Cream and the glasses. And I mean, the change from one year to the next, I was following the coverage in the Daily News and Chicago Tribune. The columnists who were much older were like, who are these people? Wearing carpet bags on their sleeves. You know, they were very stunned by the transformation. Yeah.
Well, and during the riots, Abbie Hoffman was here and he would do the improv set so that he'd get seen and then he'd just leave. And I mean, like the Nate Herman, who was a musical director for that cast, I've had these endless conversations about this period because it's so, it was very fascinating to me, especially it was when Bush the second got elected that I, as a producer and the cast that was on stage at the time who were doing very left comedy, were getting a very visceral, problematic response, which we were unaccustomed to. It just was. And Nate, I remember Nate coming and goes, oh, that was what it was like when I was doing this stuff at that time. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And then you just, I don't think you realize when you're in these fallow times where everyone's like, thinks everything's right. I mean, again, Trump, that happened again, you know, when that happened. Not the case during the Obama years. Just not quite at that sort of level. And right now, it's not necessarily as sharp or pointed. I wonder if that's going to change the closer we get to the election. But I mean, this time period, so you have Lampoon come in. So you already have all these, you've already name dropped it in terms of like the second, all the amazing Second City people. But then these amazing people from Lampoon and Tony Hendra, who's a critical figure, coming in and scouting for Belushi. And I guess this is the other thing that you note, is that the cast was seemingly eager to let John hog the stage so that Lampoon would take him.
So that they'd be rid of him. Yeah. I don't know if the group from that era pulled any punches in talking to me about Belushi after all these years, but they sounded genuinely warm toward him. And I think they were willing to forgive him his many abuses. Again, the fact he would occupy the position of power on the stage. He would literally just be like pretending to shoot up, you know, all by himself, doing his own thing, and people would be howling with laughter. And Joe Flaherty, great Joe Flaherty, told me, you know, like, what the heck's going on? Oh, it's Belushi. He's shooting up again. And he'd just get carried away. I think he had maybe some insecurity himself, maybe like Chris Farley, but the way he expressed it was a little different. He just, I think, loved drawing the focus to himself. And he had this powerful gravitational pull, I think. And so he walked on stage. He didn't have to do very much, maybe just raise the eyebrow.
Yeah.
Which Flaherty also did very well. They were both good eyebrow raisers. Mm-hmm. And just, he'd pull all the attention to himself. One other thing I want to say about Belushi, I figured this out in doing the book, that he was a jock.
Yeah.
Like a teetotaling jock just a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
And just like America, he transformed pretty radically from a jock who literally turned in the quarterback for drinking beer to hippie stoner to anti-war activist getting sprayed, you know, in the 68 police riots over the course of a couple of years, and just a transformation. And Judy, his poor girlfriend, had to deal with this because Judy was from a conservative family in Wheaton, and she had been raised, you know, as a good conservative girl. And then suddenly her boyfriend is smoking reefer, you know, so she was being dragged along on this political transformation that John went through.
And I, you know, I've read a bunch of the SNL books, and I don't recall reportage that Lorne maybe didn't want John in that cast.
Oh, I think Lorne was afraid of John. Now, I didn't interview Lorne Michaels. I mean, there's just one of him, right? He runs this vast empire, so I don't blame him for not being able to talk to me. I had to go way back to some books from the 80s and some interviews he did with Rolling Stone in the 70s when he was more available. But yeah, And I interviewed some of his fellow travelers, like Tom Schiller, you know, the filmmaker,
yep.
and Zweibel, who was great, Alan Zweibel, mm-hmm. the writer. And yeah, I sensed that Lorne knew that John was a powder keg, in a good way and a bad way, right? And I think that he sensed from the beginning that he was going to be trouble. I mean, before Belushi even interviewed for the part in Saturday Night Live, he sort of made an ass of himself. I think Belushi, again, getting to his insecurities, would try to sort of sabotage himself because he was afraid he wouldn't get the part. So his first meeting with Lorne, Belushi sort of says, television is crap. You know, I spit on my television. I throw my television out the window. I hate television. And Lorne's like, well, why the hell are you here then?
Yeah.
And Belushi hadn't even shaved and looked horrible. So, well, because, you know, I heard you got, who was the Ann Beats and,
Rosie Schuster
and yeah, he'd heard that Lorne was working with some cool people from Lampoon, and okay, so maybe this show will be different. But he made an ass of himself the very first time he met Lorne, and Lorne knew that he was going to be trouble. There's no question of that.
So how, and I know it's in the book, but tell us how the Blues Brothers showed up on SNL, like, cause that wasn't like, people weren't thinking this was a good idea, right?
There was kind of, I see it as kind of like there was a phase one and a phase two and a phase three of the Blues Brothers. At the time that Saturday Night Live debuted, at the very beginning, there was the band, right? The SNL band, in which Paul Schaefer was involved. I interviewed Paul.
Great band, too. These are
great crack band. And so different performers from the cast would kind of go hang out with the band in the warmups and would kind of like, I don't know what they would do, sing or dance or do stand up or whatever. But Belushi and Aykroyd at the very beginning in 1975 worked up a little act because they were both frustrated musicians. Aykroyd had played drums and harmonica and, you know, would carry on in these blues clubs in Ottawa, which is where he was raised. And Belushi had played drums also, in high school bands in Wheaton, Illinois. And they both just loved rock and roll. They both, I think Aykroyd was more into the blues. Belushi was more into sort of metal and Zeppelin and that. But they both were frustrated musicians, as so many comedians are. And so they worked up this act. And if you watch the very first season of SNL, they are on stage, live television, in January of 76 in bee costumes, singing I'm a King Bee. And that is the first iteration, I would argue, of the Blues Brothers. They weren't called the Blues Brothers then, although supposedly the Oscar-winning composer, whose name I'm going to forget, who was the musical director of Saturday Night Live, Canadian guy, he's brilliant. He scored Lord of the Rings. Anyway, he supposedly came up with, hey, you guys should call yourselves the Blues Brothers. But that was all it was. And then I think that, so the characters kind of existed, but then they kind of went into a hibernation because you don't see or hear anything about the Blues Brothers for a couple of years after that. And then Belushi goes to Oregon to shoot Animal House and play Bluto. And he meets this character named Curtis Salgado. Some of you who listen to this will have heard of Curtis Salgado. Many of you will know the name Robert Cray.
Sure.
That was the band. It was the Robert Cray, the Crayhawks. Robert Cray, Curtis Salgado were kind of the guitarist and frontman. Salgado invigorated Belushi's interest in the blues. I don't think he'd been a big blues hound before then. Mm-hmm. And he came back from the Animal House shoot just brimming with blues. And that's when you start getting the dark sunglasses and the hat and the suit and the look. And Belushi had this, you know, volcanic energy. So once he was interested in the Blues Brothers, it took flight very quickly. And then it's just a matter of a handful of months before they talk Lorne into putting them on the air as the Blues Brothers. And the characters, which I would argue Aykroyd, who's the detail guy, had kind of fleshed out. Knowing Aykroyd, I'm sure he wrote in his brain an elaborate backstory for them.
Oh, yeah.
They'd raised in an orphanage, blah, blah, blah. And he loved Chicago so much and loved Belushi that they became these Chicago ne'er-do-wells. And so then they debut in arguably the greatest SNL episode ever in history. I think I may have seen it when it aired. Maybe you did too. It was Steve Martin, the King Tut episode.
King Tut episode, yep.
But it's also the Blues Brothers. It's a brilliant episode just from start to finish. There's just utter.
It's got the Gilda dance piece with Steve Martin as well, right?
That may be. I know it had King Tut. I know it had two Blues Brothers performances. It had, I think it had the medieval barber.
Yeah, York. Yes.
It had some great stuff in it.
Yeah. In what is Because the critiques of SNL go on today, just like they do with Second City, where people are like, it's not like it used to be. They've been saying it's not like it's used to be since episode two. So it's like, it is hit or miss. It is sketch comedy, and it is of its time. So in its time, it has a different kind of effect than, you know, you trying to watch it now.
I've watched SNL since the first cast.
Yeah.
Personally, I would say maybe the high watermark in terms of just from sketch to sketch being great for me was probably the era of Kristen Wiig, and maybe, I don't know if these people entirely overlap, but Fred Armisen,
yeah.
and Bill Hader.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the high points and just the beating heart of the show, you can't top the first cast. And, so when they do these all-time rankings of SNL greats, I would say Belushi would have come out on top. Lately, Eddie Murphy's getting more of a nod because people think more of that era of SNL than they used to. And I think nowadays, especially when Eddie Murphy came back and did that amazing hosting segment, it's like he really was pretty much, I mean, he just was so much better than anyone else in that era of SNL and was such an amazing talent that maybe but it's one or the other of those two, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah,
have your own opinion.
So the Blues Brothers movie. So the thing that I know in terms of we do a tour, we've done a tour of Old Town, tour of Second City kind of thing, and we always show them. We say across the street here, which was the Earl of Old Town, it's now Corcoran's. It's a bar. In the back was the Blues Bar, not the first Blues Bar. That was in New York. Right, in terms of an illegal
same named place. Yep, that's same, right. Okay. The one in New York was the one where all these luminaries, I mean, the Grateful Dead and, you know, ZZ Top and Keith Richard tending bar and all that.
Yeah. So the Blues Brothers, the Blues Bar here were people working on the movie, Second City people, and Chicago cops, primarily, as I understand it.
Yeah, and there's a great story in the book about how one night they were there, and it was obviously a boozy joint, but also there was a fragrant, yeah, and powdery. And one night they're there with the guy who was the the chief of the Joliet prison, the warden. Mm-hmm. I interviewed him, the warden. He's sitting there, and they're passing around, I guess, a film canister filled with weed. And apparently it passed through several pairs of hands, and then Jackson Brown has it, and he hands it to the warden, and then the warden has this can full of weed, and he just looks at it as a and just passed it on. Yeah, that was the Blues Bar.
My dad was interviewing Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead, but it was a Bobby and the Midnight Show at Park West here. And my friend Dave and I came along, and we went backstage with them. And as my dad's interviewing Bob Weir, he and the band all pass around this joint. The joint goes to my dad. My dad then hands me the joint. I had to make this decision in a split moment. I'm like, I cannot not take a toke off this joint that Bob Weir just had in his mouth.
Wow.
And I remember my dad going, we don't need to talk about it.
So that's, you can just say later that you didn't inhale.
Yeah, I didn't. Exactly. That was the thing. So this movie took over Chicago. And I know it's very fun to sort of talk about it and look back at it, but it was also debaucherous in a really unhealthy way, which it really felt like there's a sadness underneath this in terms of John losing his grip on how to reconcile this success, this fame, this talent with the drugs and all that. So I mean, that is an area where I think you do a very deft job of being able to show the excitement and the joy with this underlying, just really sort of, we all know where this is going.
Yeah. So, there's so much to unpack here. First of all, let me just say that Chicago has this wonderful small town aspect to it. The city has this way that it can focus in on itself in a way that totally, I don't think LA or New York could. And so the film really did take over the city. I mean, they commanded the roadways at certain times, and everyone in town knew it was happening. The Tribune's writing columns about it. And I think people were like, oh, look, it's the Blues Brothers, you know. And it opened up this film industry that had been moribund for two decades because Mayor Daley had taken offense when they shot some kind of a corrupt cop show there, and he just shut it all down. So Mayor Byrne revives it. And so, yeah, they had the run of the city. And as far as the drugs and stuff, I want to say that John Landis and the people at Universal, like Sean Daniel and Tom Mount, would tell you that the druggy reputation is overblown. It's easy, all too easy to say, oh, this was a coke-addled production. Okay, well, if you unpack that, first of all, I think most movie productions in that era had lots and lots of hot and cold running cocaine. Second point I would make is not everybody was doing it. Landis, as far as I know, was a teetotaler. I don't think he even drank. And the same thing with his assistant director. So there were people, the band members certainly were buzzed most of the time. Most of the time. And Aykroyd has said, and I'm sure the studio people hate this, Aykroyd has said over and over again, there was a cocaine budget. Well, there wasn't an actual budget line item for cocaine, but there was certainly a machinery and apparatus in place. I have a scene in the book where another film canister arrives on the set filled with cocaine. And when I was in the review copy stage of this book, let's just say that one or two people took grave exception to that and thought that it hadn't happened and wasn't true. And I considered taking it out, but I went and found a second source.
Yeah.
And so then I had two solid on the record sources. Well, actually, I didn't put them on the record in the book, but to me, they're on the record saying that this happened. So, yeah, it was there. I think if Landis were on this call, he would say it wasn't like out of proportion probably to other Hollywood productions. It certainly didn't impede ultimately with the movie getting made. Belushi's many, many transgressions, and I lay out a lot in the book, cost the production a couple days, 3 days shooting maybe, but this film was like 20 days behind by the time they left Chicago. So it wasn't just Belushi's fault. They were doing crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Just crazy stuff, driving cars off bridges and collapsing cars, driving through plate glass windows, crashing cars dozens at a time, and then rebuilding them in this shop that was in a very dangerous section of the west side of Chicago at the time.
So I remember this show, this movie getting great reviews because I saw Siskel and Ebert.
They loved it. Yeah.
But that was not Universal.
That was about it. I don't think I found another positive review. And I went down the list from Time, Newsweek, The Times, The Post, down to like the Wilmington Star Journal. And I could not find another positive review. People forget this, but outside Chicago, the movie was not loved by the critics.
Right. But how'd it do?
Oh, it did great. In fact, I think it did $1 million in business in the first week in Chicago, where it was only playing in like 10 theaters. So, I mean, that was like packed house after packed house after packed house. And it did about $1 million a day, which in that era that's a blockbuster pace. They took out ads in, I think it was Variety, with the little dancing guys, just like the cover of my book, the little dancing guys beneath a huge banner, 72-point headline saying, you know, 14 days, $14 million. And they kept that pace, a pace exceeded only by the second Star Wars movie, Empire Strikes Back, right?
Yeah.
For two or three months. And in the end, it was a hit. I think it was the second biggest film of the year. I'm probably wrong about that, but it was close to it didn't top The Empire Strikes Back, but it did very, very well.
All right. Yeah. And then Spark. And I remember that last tour because they went on tour afterwards. And I remember seeing the Blues Brothers at Poplar Creek. And I remember this also because I was with my dad and we were sitting right behind Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer. which was hilarious because they liked my dad was the only one they liked at WGM. They called him Sugar Roy, and we're just having this conversation. But that would be one of the final performances of the Blues Brothers.
Yeah. So you're referring to this whirlwind tour they did, I think, right after the film came out.
Yeah.
I did not see them at Poplar Creek. I lived in the middle of the city and had no car, so I saw, you know, shows at the 9:30 club. Well, actually not in 1980. I wasn't seeing anything. But anyway, the point being that at the end of that tour, I think it was like 24 dates, I mentioned in the book that was the last time the two guys would play on stage together as the Blues Brothers. It was over. They didn't know it at the time, but that was it.
So talk a little bit about, I thought one of the fascinating things was, so they took some heat, and I get why, in terms of appropriation, I guess would be the word. So
yes,
all these wonderful artists that they put in the film, Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin, yeah. John Lee Hooker, you know, all these people who are, and some who had Muddy Waters was supposed to be, and yeah. and wasn't. I think what people don't recognize is that these people weren't at a place, Cab Calloway, where they were being recognized, where yeah. they could sell records, where they could sell tickets. And it really was this film that allowed them to sort of take their careers and sort of reclaim them in some ways, right?
Yes. Before, though, I want to ask you a question before I answer that one. Chris Borelli from the Tribune asked me the other day to talk about Belushi's severe limitations as a singer, which gets to the question you're asking me, and how, like, if you play a Blues Brothers record now, like a song on YouTube, it doesn't sound very good. The vocals don't sound very good. Yeah. So Chris was like, what did you know, he asked me, what do you think of Belushi as a vocalist? So let me ask you, were sitting in Poplar Creek.
Yeah.
Tell the audience about Belushi as a frontman live on stage, the difference between that and hearing it on a record.
Belushi was an incredible frontman.
Yeah.
Because it was energy and presence, and it wasn't, I mean, technically Bob Dylan is not a good singer. That doesn't mean that Bob Dylan isn't amazing as a performer in terms of his phrasing and his writing and the different things that come with that. And even more so, you know, rock singers, the Janis Joplins, and Janis had great pipes, but no, Belushi, not a great singer, but an incredible front man. And Danny was a passable harmonica player, but here's the deal. They were playing characters who are in front of also one of the, I mean, these guys are all like sort of Muscle Shoals guys, aren't they? Like Cropper and Dunn.
Oh my God. The band was just.
Yeah. They're
fearless.
Yeah. And Steve Cropper's, my friend Seamus, that's his stepdad. And so he's come to Second City shows before. But yeah, the band was so incredible tight, but you weren't there to see John Belushi as a singer. You were there to see John Belushi as Juliet Jake in character.
Yeah.
And again, I was a young person who was, you know, I was seeing Caddyshack. I was seeing Meatballs. I even went to see 1941, which
at what age was this? 13?
What am I? Like, 13.
Oh,
but
my
again,
goodness.
This was because it was my dad's job. He reviewed film.
Okay.
And he interviewed Belushi and Aykroyd, and they knew him because they knew Belushi did, because he knew his Chicago stuff. And Danny loved Chicago. I mean, like we did cast trades and other things. So, you know, and I know and you have this in the book, he would come here and he would explore, like, Chess Records and you know, all the great clubs and, you know, Wise Fools and Biddy Mulligans and all the great clubs. So, yeah, I just remember that's a concert that I will remember forever for the spectacle of it, and the fact that it was the end, it was the last.
Yeah, and to Chris Borelli's point though, he's right that what he was getting at is if you listen to a recording of the Blues Brothers and listen to Belushi, it's not the same because you're not seeing experiencing the character. But yeah, to the appropriation, happily. The issue of cultural appropriation was thoroughly aired at the time when the Blues Brothers record came out, the first one, and well before the film came out, they were assailed and attacked in Rolling Stone, even though Rolling Stone was kind of the newspaper of record for Belushi and generally they loved him.
Yeah.
There were voices, I think, like Dave Marsh in Rolling Stone that eviscerated them for cultural appropriation. I may be wrong about Marsh, but somebody in that page, more than one writer in Rolling Stone, just tore them apart for that. And the alternative press, like the Berkeley Barb, you know, the Chicago Seed probably wasn't still around, but whatever. The alternative papers really, really attacked them. And it was the same point that people would make now, which is that how dare they have this white, almost all white band, albeit with the, you know, the Stax rhythm section, playing, appropriating the works of great black rhythm blues artists. Now, I'll add that they didn't do, some of the songs they did were by white blues artists, but they themselves were probably appropriating black blues artists. So,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't really help you. So that's a good thing that those arguments played out at the time, because I was able to simply quote them. And anybody reading the book now can take that into, you know, under advisement and decide how they feel about it. A point that I make in the book, and this is something you can't really argue with, is Universal was going to make a movie about the Blues Brothers. There was no way that wasn't going to happen. They were huge. This is the first point you made when we started talking. It was, they were massive.
Yep.
And there was no way that a film about the Blues Brothers wasn't going to star the Blues Brothers.
Yep.
I mean, Danny, to his credit, and John Landis, to his credit, and Belushi, to his credit, turned the film into a showcase for their heroes, basically. Aretha, James Brown. And I will challenge you to go on YouTube and find a visual sort of artifact of their greatness to surpass those scenes in the Blues Brothers. I mean, you've got James Brown at the Tammy Show. Obviously, there's lots of wonderful footage of Aretha, but those scenes, those musical numbers from the Blues Brothers are just fabulous. And they've got millions of hits on YouTube. And that, I mean, that right there, maybe more than anything else, the presence of those artists on the film, Aretha, James Brown, Cab Calloway, so forth, that's why the film was immortal, you know. So, and it was the one part of the film that most of the critics liked. I don't think any critics said they didn't like Aretha's performance.
Yeah, or Ray Charles. Like, yeah, that's again Ray's. Iconic. That song and that scene. Yeah. All right, well, I could talk to you for days about this. It's so fascinating. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Oh, I hope I'm understanding the concept correctly.
Go for it.
7 years ago, it was right after Trump was elected president, we were faced with the decision of whether to get a dog. And I'd always avoided having a dog because it's a lot of work. It's like having a kid, and we already had two of those.
Yeah.
But I said yes. And the and part was, okay, that means that my life is going to have to, if not change, stay in this lane that I was occupying at the time. 7 years ago, I was a full-time book writer. That's all I did. Mm-hmm. So I was freelance. I was working out of my house writing books. And so that meant for the next, how long does the dog live? 12 years. I was going to have to basically somehow keep doing that. So it was all fine for the first 5 years or so. I went back into the 9-to-5 working world in 2022. And that might have been a problem, except that because of the pandemic, a lot of journalism had gone virtual. And so since that fall of 2022, I have worked virtually. And so I have not seen an office in the 7 years I've had the dog, even though I've been working 9-to-5 every day since, you know, a year and a half ago. So that was the end.
That's a perfect yes and, because so many reasons. But in the end, because you can't predict anything. Like, you don't know what is going to happen. And sometimes you just like, and you got the dog, and I'm sure the dog's awesome. And certainly we always grew up with dogs. My kids have dogs. You wouldn't have known that otherwise. And lo and behold.
Well, Kelly, what's your favorite single Second City cast ever from Canada, United States, anywhere? Do you have a single cast you like the most?
See, I'm going to have to, so because I didn't see, I mean, my first casts when I started coming to shows in Chicago were the Jim Belushi era. So okay. George Wendt, Tim Kazurinsky, those guys. So I have a fondness and a memory of first seeing them. But I produced a show called Pinata Full of Bees in 1995 that Adam McKay and Rachel Dratch were in, and Scott Allman and Jenna Chalovitz and Kevin Dorff, and that kind of put me on the map as a producer.
Okay.
And so I have a fondness for that show. And it was in very much, we were breaking molds. We tore down the stage. The whole premise of the show was that we had recurring scenes. The premise of the show was that Noam Chomsky was substitute teaching a grade school class and teaching them about the real America, where he was just upsetting the children. And it is renowned. People talk about the show forever. Worst selling show in the modern era at Second City. And what I didn't know, and this was my yes and, was like, yes, we're going to do this. And what it means is we're going to develop a new audience for the Second City moving forward, which we kind of needed to do, in the same way that now I look back at Next Generation, knowing they alienated a core audience that it was time to alienate.
Okay.
And that is a very difficult thing to do when you have success. Is then, you know, it's the thing that I admire in people like Neil Young and Lou Reed, who take chances, David Bowie, on their material of alienating audiences and then getting them back or getting new audiences. So I think it's all of a piece in terms of this conversation, knowing that Belushi broke a mold. Aykroyd, while maybe not breaking a mold, was such a consummate professional in all this regard that I don't think Belushi is successful without an Aykroyd. It's almost like all that id alone doesn't necessarily work, and just Danny being brilliant maybe doesn't have this other spark that then is this friendship that is also an artistic, an amazing artistic thing. And I the one regret I have, I'm curious about you on this, is the fact that the demons seem to get in the way of them being able to find more there. Because I don't think we didn't see it in Neighbors.
Yeah. Well, every one of my books has had a villain. And the villain in this book is addiction, basically.
Yeah.
And if I succeeded on any level in this book, I hope that I succeeded at getting just the whimsy is not the right word, it sounds goofy, but just the joy and the funny and just the laugh out loud humor that went on every single day of Belushi's life until he was out of days, you know, and to emphasize that over the villain winning in the end, you know.
It's a great book. It's called The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic. Daniel, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.